Hi, it's another Friday, and that means it's another edition. Edition number 59 of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. Those of you who watch are familiar with the format. Jeremy and I take a look at some items in the news, some of the bigger things, and then maybe some of the short-term things, and give our point of view each, always discussing respectfully and honorably and quietly, at least so far in the first 58 weeks. And so here we go. How you doing, Jer?
I'm doing well. Spring's around the corner. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. It feels it. It does feel it. So I just came up with this, as I always come up with things right before when I say, oh, God, what are we going to talk about? So I've got a kind of a bigger issue and then an immediate issue. I'll just tell you what I'm thinking. You tell me if it makes sense. So we've had some hearings this week in Congress, you know, on the whole issue of January 6th and what happened January 6th. And I mean, there's been plenty of news about what happened and why it happened. But what I'd like to do is let's try our hand on the key question. How do we avert that sort of thing? How do we prevent that sort of riot and real threat to our democracy from happening again? So that's the first issue. And then the second issue, arguably, let's say those of us who live in New York State are on kind of a death watch for the governorship of Andrew Cuomo. Are his days really numbered? How bad is this? And, you know, we are pollsters and predictors, and we've done a little bit of work in New York, in fact, just this past week. Let's take a look at what we think we're going to be talking about. We're going to close the book on Andrew Cuomo next week, or does he hang on for a while? How do those topics sound to you?
Let's roll with them.
Okay, good. All right, so this issue of preventing January 6th and trying to understand what happened actually came up yesterday in a lecture that I gave. I want to plug the Mohawk Valley Institute for Learning and Retirement, pioneering program mainly of, for, and by people of a certain age, those who are retired, who have some time and want to spend some time taking informal courses and learning anything from courses in world affairs to reading Russian novels to wine tasting. It's a wonderful program that SUNY here in Utica actually pioneered about 25 years ago. And so I had the honor of speaking to them again. It's been many times. And that issue came up, you know, January 6th, how do we make sure it doesn't happen again? I was put on the spot. Here are some of the things that I thought were relevant. For starters, in terms of criminal justice and policing, I think the system, by and large, worked. I mean, we had the hardware, we had the capacity for the people being present, we had multiple agencies. Once again, not unlike 9/11, where the same ingredients existed, the difficulty was a lack of communication, poor communication. We can assess blame, and I think that that's where Congress will end up in its report. Who didn't communicate? Who didn't act? Who should have been more aware and forthright? But the resources, by and large, were there. That's one piece of it. The other piece of it is, how do you cut off the oxygen that allows this kind of fomenting of a riot and this kind of a challenge to democratic institutions from happening again? And how do you isolate the cancer, so to speak? And I think that's an issue that warrants, you know, some considerable attention. You know, we did some work after 9/11 in Muslim countries from Indonesia to Mauritania and all points in between. And it was for the Central Command, U.S. military. And by and large, the question was the very same thing. How do you cut off the oxygen to then Al-Qaeda? And essentially, you know, through deep study and surveys and focus groups, we learned that the number one, Muslims do not want to hear about killing other Muslims. If you can show that that's Al-Qaeda's mission is to kill other Muslims, that will reduce support dramatically. The second thing is that when it comes to the United States communicating its values, American values, to these countries, the United States has to learn that communication means listening, not just talking all the time. I think that's the hardest message for a superpower to learn. In any event, as you know the story, over the course of a few years, after our recommendations, when we went back and tested most of these countries, we saw that support for Al-Qaeda in whether it was Jordan or the Horn of Africa or Indonesia had declined from about 12 to 15%, which is enough of a cushion of support, oxygen to allow Al-Qaeda to function, reduced down to 2 or 3%, which is enough to then be able to isolate it, to prevent safe houses from happening, a network of support. And we were really proud of that work. We've got a problem with right-wing militias. We have a problem with a bevy of a larger group of sympathizers for the messages of white supremacy and racism and the challenging of our electoral process. How do we apply the same principles and kind of choke that and make it easier then to put white supremacy where it was and where it belongs, which is way over on the fringe and invisible and out of the way? And I guess that's my question for you, and it's not an easy one, but what do you think?
So that job you did in the Middle East, that was for CENTCOM?
Yes. We did it with the Brandon group.
I wish I took part in that. So I mean, I've heard you reference it, and I've read the executive summary, but I think you're the better person to answer. So based on the principles of what you found and what you learned, I really believe that you're in a better position to answer that. So how do you draw the parallels from that and apply it to the situation today?
Well, all right, let me go in order here. So number one, let me say that working with Central Command taught me that military brass are among the smartest people we have in this country. They think strategically, and they are the ones who want to avoid war at all costs. They're on the front lines. There are very few Dr. Strangeloves in those rooms. These are people that know war and want to avoid it. That's number one. There's real competence. Number two is the fact that they really wanted to learn on the ground, what are people thinking? Rather than the earlier approach immediately after 9/11, where we thought we were going to combat Islamic radicalism by producing television ads with Muslim characters adopting American values. That was, again, the superpower talking and not listening. And so what we learned is we've got to go, whoever we is, need to go into communities and listen. And who are those communities? Not necessarily the obvious thought leaders, but the heads of families, the influential guy who runs the bodega, the the scout leader, the people who are really on the teacher, the on the front lines who deal directly with people and have an ear to the ground. And we have to listen. What are the real concerns? Let me be critical of my fellow liberals and progressives. You know, we condemn white supremacy and condemn racism, but to call 42% of the American people a basket full of deplorables is insane. And at the very least, politically, it's counterproductive. We've got to understand who the overwhelming majority of these people are, what makes them tick, and try to understand then how we can work together to neutralize that sentiment. What do they need to hear? What kind of action do they need to have? What is the source of the distrust? Mm-hmm. And then neutralize it. That's what we did in the Arab world. Now, I'm not going to say we did it. That's what we recommended. And to their credit, it was the military and the public diplomacy people who enacted it. And I learned so much. Our folks, our clients, talked to family leaders. They engaged with people. Instead of putting up billboards, they met one-on-one and in small groups, always respectful. In addition to that, I think one of the most exciting things that was done was they took a look at American institutions in various cities. So Pakistan, we learned that in Islamabad, there used to be 4 American libraries where people could learn American values and American literature, but because of budget cuts after the Cold War ended, there it was reduced down to 1 library, and it wasn't particularly accessible. That what we learned is that, I mean, that may not seem like a big deal, well, who goes to libraries, but it was viewed by the folks that we had spoken to as a sign of disrespect.
If I could just interject and just ask you, because that's all of that information is fascinating. I would just ask you, from all of that, what do you think is one application for the American context that could work? At least to start.
Listening. Let's reduce this worse than counterproductive rhetoric on both sides. Mm-hmm. It's both sides that consider the other side not simply a worthy opponent, but as an obstruction, as a threat to American values. Regardless of which side you're on, liberals calling the 41-42% the basket full of deplorables, the conservatives on the other side holding a convention where they're actually laughing at Ted Cruz, ignoring his own people who are suffering, and making a joke about the other side as a threat to American values. That rhetoric has got to be reduced.
So my question is, because I'm independent, and I've said this many times, I haven't voted since 2012. I'm not even on the voter list, and I am just as skeptical of the Democrats as I am the Republicans. And so I think it puts me in a unique position to see the symmetry of hate. And what I mean by that is the hate on both sides. But I often only hear about white supremacy, I've heard what I think alludes to the notion that there's no equivalency on the left. Do you agree with that?
I wouldn't go that far. I do believe that to a great degree, Antifa is mythological. That's not to say that there aren't left-wing radicals, anarchists, troublemakers, some of whom are paid troublemakers, agents provocateurs, and so on. But I think it's conflated with Black Lives Matter, and I think it's blown out of proportion. I do believe there's legitimate anger on both sides. Look, whether I'm a blue-collar worker or a middle-class, middle-American, watching so many changes taking place in front of me, demographic changes, changes to my finances and my kids' future, changes to the cost of education and the value of that education, changes to the respect or lack of respect that the United States has in the world. I want explanations. And I want, not simplistic, but, you know, I can't read a 100-page white paper or a history of this. I need to have it explained to me. And I think that the causes and the solutions by political demagogues are way too facile,
yeah,
and dangerous. But there is also anger on the left, and there is legitimate anger and rage over on the left too, but not just historical racism, but racism last night.
So two things that I want to say. It's like, we know QAnon's real, right?
Yes,
and, we do. And we know that Antifa is real. I'm fascinated why those on the left are so convinced that QAnon I wouldn't conflate QAnon and white supremacy. I'm sure there's crossover, but I would ask, what evidence do you have that 70, 60, 80% of QAnoners are KKK or neo-Nazis, and what evidence do you have that the majority of neo-Nazis and KKKers are Q? We don't know. We don't know what percentage of Republicans identify with that stuff. If I had to guess, I would say the vast majority of Republicans don't, just like I don't think the vast majority of Democrats think like Antifa. But I often hear, well, Antifa's mythological, it's made up, but QAnon is in, and white supremacy are strongly rooted in society. Well, I mean, look, this may sound controversial to you, but explain to me why it is. So people will talk about, obviously, the serious threat that happened on January 6th, right? Storming the Capitol building is breaking and entering a place that is not supposed to be trespassed. That's a federal crime. We all know that, okay? And overwhelming the police. But you take, you say that maybe 100, 200, 300 people did that, but tens of thousands didn't. And now you want to say that sliver is representative of the tens of thousands who did not storm the Capitol and moved away from it. Now, put that aside and ask yourself, remember Chaz? Remember the siege that took place in Seattle? I believe it was Seattle. I don't think it was Portland, where for months you had, I'm going to say, lunatics take, literally siege a Capitol building and block it off and say, we are declaring this an autonomous zone. That's secession, by the way. That in itself, if Lincoln were president, would have sent in the military and would have slaughtered them, just like he did to the South. So how can we say that one is a threat to democracy and one is evil and dangerous, but for completely forget about the equivalent on the opposite side? So that's what it comes down to listening. It comes down to admitting that don't just scapegoat it to one side. We are a society that is radicalizing. And don't pretend for one second that the radicalization only exists on one side of the political spectrum. It exists on both. I can clearly see the radicalization of the left and the right. And I do have something to follow up on, but I'll step back.
No, I think you misunderstand me. For starters, I'm not. You said a lot of things. QAnon exists, but QAnon is somewhat, or maybe even to a great degree, different from white supremacy. QAnon are crazy conspiracy theorists who have support among even the least likely and professional, well-educated people. That's something I'm trying to come to grips with. White supremacists are fringe, but they have a larger group of support behind them than they've had in years. That's on the right. On the left, Antifa does in fact exist, and whether it's in addition to that Antifa or an outgrowth of Antifa, there are anarchists and troublemakers and agents provocateurs among us, and that is equally dangerous. By the same token, though, there is a legitimate anti-racist movement, anti-white supremacist movement, and so on. So let's not confuse, or let's not say that we're dismissing one and favoring another.
Well, it's not necessarily you. It's just that tends to be what you see coming out of liberal-leaning mainstream media outlets. But continue.
Yeah. No, the bottom line here is that how do we isolate QAnon? And for that matter, how do we isolate Antifa? But to think that this is everything is a battle between Antifa on the left and QAnon on the right is a mistake. These are small groups of people. Now, one thing I do want to correct you on, and that is that on January 6th, it was much more than just a few hundred that stormed the Capitol.
No, I mean got inside of the building.
Well, all right, inside of the building, but there were hundreds, even thousands of others who were cheering them on outside. This was much larger on the spot, much larger in the nation. Why do 75% of Republicans still say that Donald Trump won the election without not only a piece of evidence to it, but in a direct challenge to a legitimate vote that's been certified by multiple layers of our system? All right, we've gotten into this issue. Why don't you close it? Because I want to talk for a few minutes about
quantum. Well, it starts with the media. And they have to start. Look, if it hasn't become obvious, to me, it's obvious. The media, whether it's Fox News, CNN, NBC, CBS, ABC, MSNBC, CSNBC, the whole thing, they are opinion molders. Their purpose is to shape opinion. But that is not the role of a media in a free society. The media is supposed to be a wing of a free society. That is anything but free. They are controlling the information and the narrative and desperately trying to control the narrative. And, you know, CNN the other day did a focus group on QAnon. And it was like, it was three former supporters and family members of QAnon supporters. And what they were doing was they were basically making it seem like if you listen to Newsmax, I mean this was said. If you listen to Newsmax, if you listen to Tucker Carlson, if you listen to outlets like that, that's no different than QAnon. Well, that's absolutely nonsense. Just like it would be to say if Fox News says that, well, you know, all the liberal media outlets are a bunch of socialist commies. So that's the danger.
Which
they do, and I'm saying that, but the danger is the opinion molding and not engaging in real debate and discussion, closing it off and not allowing voices from the other side who are legitimate to come on and let the public decide for themselves. They control the narrative. The problem, look, I tend to see hate as hate, whether it's white supremacy or whether it's people saying classics is inherent, and classics studies and math are inherently racist. And if you're white, you have white privilege and you need to be shameful and feel guilty of yourself. So, I mean, so essentially they're saying that my little boy is going to have to grow up feeling guilty about being white. And this comes from a lot of the Antifa crowd, but that's far from what Martin Luther King was saying when he said, we have to reach a point where we judge people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. So whether it's white supremacy or whether it's your white privilege because your skin is white, and if you study math or science, those subjects are inherently racist, it's hate. Now, I'm not going to get into which one is more towards pure hate. It's hate. I'm just going to say that. So it starts with the media on all sides being honest and allowing for debate and discussion and not trying to define the opposition and conflate them all as horrible people.
I'll only end, if I'm allowed the final word on this, by saying, and yet we live at a time when those mainstream media outlets, the cable television and so on, are not dominant. We have our own sources of media. We're all subject to, are dominated by clickbait, whether we're launching our own tweets and Facebook likes and Instagrams, or whether we're just simply turning off and tuning out cable television. So I'm just not so sure that mainstream media is the dominant force in our lives. So
it's really big tech. I mean, so yeah, I mean, there's mainstream network news and then there's big tech, and look how narrow of a conversation Silicon Valley, you know, big tech companies allow.
So I'm just looking at the clock right now. Let's make this a lightning rod and a lightning round, just one or two sentence answer, and then we'll talk more about it next week. Will Andrew Cuomo still be governor of New York State when we do our podcast next week? Yes or no, or maybe?
That's a tough one. If you go by his, and I only saw the 5-minute clip of it. I didn't watch the whole press conference, but it seems like he could be. He said he wasn't going to step down, right? But sometimes when you say that, that almost puts you in a position where you get heckled and harassed even more to step down. But he was a whimpering dog. It didn't come off genuine to me. I can't remember who the poll was, but I saw a poll and 50% said yes, 30% said no, 20% said not sure. But does Cuomo really care about public opinion?
And that was about resigning.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to say maybe or maybe not governor next week. He's in real trouble. And regardless of the dominant news right now about his treatment of young women, number one, I do believe that there will be more who come out, who are waiting in the wings. And number two, to a great degree, as big and important an issue as it is, it's still covering up the fact that he's in real trouble over the nursing home issue and the placement of unwell elderly people in, forgive me for saying this, death houses, and then not even bothering to count them as human beings. We haven't, to a great degree, even heard from all of those families yet, nor have we heard from Attorney General Letitia James. So I don't think that Andrew Cuomo will serve his full term. He may not serve through the week. And why don't we just call that a week, and I think a very good conversation.
A very in-depth conversation. Let me just add that if Cuomo goes down, and you're right, let's not forget about right now the focus is the sexual harassment / assaulting, and it seems to be a lot of people are maybe forgetting or just putting it to the back of their mind, the nursing home scandal. But if Cuomo goes down, other governors who may be in the same situation may have to face similar focus.
No, that's true. Yes, that's true. And we can talk about them next week as well. I'm signing off. Good week, and I'll talk to you a little later.
Take it easy. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.